Let's go through every single package installed with a Linux install image. I'm going through the software included with Slackware, but these are all open source applications and libraries, so whether you're running Slackware like me, or Fedora, Debian, BSD, or even Mac or Windows, you can probably download, install, and try these on your computer. So chances are, you'll be able to learn something from this podcast. Let's get started. Top of the list are two different, I guess, newsreaders, I'll call them. They're not exactly news. Well, one is a newsreader. The first one is Slurn, S-L-R-N, which stands for Slang Newsreader, I think. S-L-R-N, yeah. And this is from Jedsoft. So this is the, you know, the Jed editor, the text editor. This is from that developer, Jed. It seems like it's going to be a terminal-driven a terminal interface for looking at newsgroups on Usenet, which we've talked about previously. I talked about it in context of the PAN newsreader and something else, I think. So this is another newsreader that looks at Usenet and gets the latest headers or articles or posts, whatever they're called, from a specific server. The way that you're supposed to define that server is to set the environment variable NNTP server. That's all one string, all capitals, equals, you know, whatever it is, news.eternal-september.org, for example. And I'm using eternal-september.org because that's the one that has kind of some degree of open access that I know of. And I've browsed around that server in PAN, and so I know that it has content. It's not like a lot of content. It's not amazing content. I mean, I'm sure there's amazing content for people who are using it for actual things. But it does seem like the stuff that's there seems highly specific or completely just test, just people messing around with Usenet trying to figure out how to post, that sort of thing. So it's a server that exists. I've accessed it, and I tried to access it with Slurn, and nothing. So here's what I've tried. Certainly just setting NNTP server, all capitals, equals news.eternal-september.org ought to work, in theory. And because this is a new thing, I have to create, and Slurn interrupts the launch process to alert me of this. It says that the file .jnewsource, or maybe it's .jnewsrc, I don't know, must exist. And I can create that with the command slurn-f, as in file, path to where I want this .jnewsrc to be to exist, --- create. So, trying that, meaning that the command would be, well, exactly that, slurn-f, path to the file --- create. The environment variable still exists, so should be good, as long as I'm staying in the same terminal. And it does not appear to work. It says, failed to initialize the server. Okay, so trying this again, except without the environment variable. Let's do slrn-h for host, news.eternal-september.org. -p for port 563. I happen to know it's port 563 because when I was first investigating it, I took note of that. And then the whole -f path to the file that I want to use, --- create. And I think that should be good. Yes, okay. And this, it appears to hang for several, like almost a minute. And it says, again, failed to initialize server. So I don't know what's going on, except that just now, literally just now, after several attempts, failed attempts, for whatever reason, the reverse curse of demos, it suddenly started working. And I couldn't tell you which command it was exactly that got me there. I think it was slrn-h news.eternal-september.org-p563-f path to my new file --create. And for whatever reason, it just started working. So here we are in Slurn. I've never seen this before because all of my attempts to access this failed. So it seems that Slurn is, if you imagine an Alpine or a Mutt-like interface, that's kind of the way that I would describe this. It takes over your terminal screen, so you are now in Slurn. You have no terminal prompt, and you're at a top-level listing of all the news groups available to you here on this server. And if I recall correctly, this most news servers, and I think EternalSeptember.org inclusive, they're mostly paid now. You have to pay for access. And I believe Eternal September, the reason I'm on it at all is because they do have like a free tier, a $0 tier. But I think probably the quality of posts for the $0 tier probably reflect kind of like what you would get in a news group on a news server if it weren't just for pay. Like, there's a lot of just kind of like, if you look through these messages, there's a lot of just kind of not spam, but just a lot of sort of meta conversations about like, how do I use this? How does this work? What's a news server? Like, there's a lot of just weird discussion about sort of, hey, I found myself here, now what? That kind of thing. But I mean, if you've never been on a news server before, this is a way to do it, and you don't have to resort to like a GUI. This is all just in the terminal, so that's pretty cool. And you can, for instance, now that I'm at the top level, so there's only like 12 news groups listed here. So I could go into, for instance, eternal-september.support. Now, it warns you at the bottom of the window in sort of an Emacs kind of buffer kind of way, mini buffer. At the bottom, it says, hey, there are 14,224 messages here. How many do you want to read? Or I believe that what that's really saying is, how many do you actually want to download? Like, here are the headers that the Slurn is aware of. What do you actually want to see? So I'm going to say, let's do 25, which is probably too many. And it says that, yep, it's just received 25 headers or articles or posts, whatever they call them. And interestingly, there's only 7 listed here in the sort of the news group screen. But if you go into one of them, then generally speaking, you'll see that there are, not that one, generally, there we go. Generally speaking, you'll see that there's, that there are replies that kind of don't get visibly listed on the top level view until you sort of click into, or not click into, although actually you can click if you enable, there is a mouse enablement thing for Slurn. You can actually, if you're, you can apparently use your mouse, but I didn't activate that. But yeah, so if you go into a message, then you see the threads, and then you can kind of click on the threads or hit return on the threads, and you get to see those as well on the replies, the responses, and you end up with a lot more than you first, sort of first appeared, which is useful because, I mean, that way you're not just peering into a raw inbox with all, every message. You don't have to parse all that. All you're seeing are the top level conversations, and then once you descend into that message, then you get to see all the responses and the whole conversation. So to get back out of this news group, you hit Q, which seems weird, or sort of weird. I mean, Q, obviously, you think of quit, but it also kind of makes sense because if you hit Q enough, then you've quit a news group, and then you could quit quit the server, that sort of thing. And then you just use the arrow keys, or you can use Control N and P to go up and down, and return to enter, or to descend into something and read messages. And that's kind of all I know about it right now. If you hit the letter P for post, it will ask you if you want to post a message, and then it guides you through that process of posting a message to the news group, provided you have permission to do that. That's Slurn. Next after that is Snow News. Snow News is good news. Snow News is it's not really about news. It could be. It depends on what you subscribe to. It's RSS. It's an RSS feed reader. And I was going to use this, and I think I did use this for a little while at a job. These days I just use Aggregator because it's part of Kontakt in KDE, and it just makes more, I'm in there anyway checking email, so I might as well use the Aggregator for RSS and Atom feeds. Snow News itself, I find highly, highly intuitive if you've ever used a terminal, sort of interactive terminal application. I mean, it is exactly what you would imagine. A, to add an RSS feed, you type in the RSS feed in the field, and then you're subscribed to that feed. I mean, that's kind of it. Capital D deletes a highlighted RSS feed. You can do lowercase c to rename the feed. None of that's intuitive, but H gives you help. And that lists all of the things. R reloads a feed. M marks something as read. So I think those and letter P and the letter N go previous or next, or you can just use the arrow keys. Oh, S, you can sort the feeds alphabetically. Yeah, it's super useful. It's a great little reader. I have no complaints about Snow News. I think it's a great little application. It's just one of those things where it makes as much sense for me to use Aggregator. If I was using Mutt, I would probably just use Snow News, because then that would make sense. But I'm using Kontakt, so Aggregator just makes sense. It's right there, easy to access, convenient. Next on the list is SoCat, which stands for Socket Concatenator, or Socket Cat. It looks at data streams and cats it from one place to another. It's similar in spirit, I guess, to the way the cat command takes data from a file and puts it somewhere else, sends it to standard out, or puts it into another file. That's kind of what you're doing with SoCat. I don't think the uses of this are super obvious to everyone, and I imagine it's one of those tools that when you need it, it's really, really great that it exists. But I mean, certainly you can go years, decades of using Linux and never touch the SoCat command. I myself am living proof. That's just not something that I've ever needed. However, it's relatively easy to demonstrate, at least in concept. So you can do something like sudo socat tcp4-listen, that's all capitals, tcp4-listen, colon 81, arbitrarily choosing port 81, space tcp4 colon 192.1, or I guess you could do like 127. Actually, could you do that? I'm not sure you can do that. Maybe with sudo you can. It would have to be to a different place. Sorry. I think. Trying to think this through. Well, forget it. So because I have a virtual machine available, I'm going to send it to tcp4 colon 192.168.122.82 colon 80. So in other words, I am going to send it to my virtual machine's port 80. Why would I do that? What does port 80 do? It runs a web server. So am I therefore forwarding the port 81 to someone else's web server? Am I taking over their web server? No, I'm just cluttering up their logs. I'll demonstrate. There's no authentication happening here. I'm not logging into my virtual machine. I'm just literally sending data toward that IP address is port 80. What that server does with that information is obviously up to the server. So I will, just for demonstration, start up my virtual machine and SSH into it and start the httpd daemon with sudo /etc/rc.d/rc.httpd /start. That starts the server. So now there's actually something on port 80. And now I'll go back over to my desktop here and do telnet /127.0.0.1/81. So now I'm connecting to my desktop's port 81, which, remember, SOCAT is taking everything that happens on port 81 and sending it to my virtual machine, port 80. Okay, so here I am in telnet, and I'm just going to type in hello world. Okay, so I've just dumped some data into the port 81 of my desktop computer. And now I'm going to go back over to my virtual machine, and I'm going to do a less on var log httpd /access_log. And scroll down all the way to the bottom here. And here we go. From an IP 192.168.122.1, which is my desktop, today, I see a message, hello world, 400.226. So I see a message that I essentially wrote to myself on my desktop on port 81 in the server logs of my web server running on port 80 of my virtual machine. And that's because I told my desktop, I told it with SOCAT to take whatever it hears on port 81 and send it to port 80 of this other place. Now, again, that's only working... It's a convoluted example. It works, but it's only functional, really, because I started the web server on my virtual machine and then looked at the access logs to see what's been happening at port 80. In real life, I mean, you could certainly do this. I don't know that it would be very useful. You'd be cluttering up someone else's logs, and you'd probably get your IP address banned eventually if you did it often enough. So I wouldn't go doing that to all the port 80s out there on the internet. But it's a way, I mean, there you go. You've sent a message from port 81 to a different port on a different machine. So that's what SOCAT does. I mean, not that specifically, but it does, it cats data from one source, whether it's a port or a Unix socket. You can use the Unix-listen, I think it is, Unix-listen or Unix-socket, I'd have to look at the man page, to listen to a port or a socket and connect it to some other port or socket. Now, whether you have permissions to do anything useful is a completely different question. You know, I mean, you can pipe data from one place at another. It doesn't mean that other place is going to, like, you know, you haven't logged in, you haven't authenticated, you don't have a user account there. It could be that nothing is listening, you're just shouting into a void, but that is something that SOCAT can do, send data. One practical use I could find on the internet for this was someone had a remote MySQL server. This was on redhat.com/sysadmin/getting-started-socat, a really good article. The author has this remote MySQL server and wanted to use that remote MySQL server as if though it was a local server on a development machine. And so he ran some commands to with SOCAT to connect essentially the remote server to his development machine, or on his web server, I guess, and then had everything sort of connected so that, his web server was looking at just this, at this local port, or apparently local port, but actually it was getting data from this remote machine. So that was kind of interesting. But realistically, probably not a command I'm going to use very often, unless I get a job where I do need to do that sort of thing. I mean, that's a possibility as well. All right, next up is SSHFS. This is easy. This is a great one. This is wonderful. I love this. SSHFS is a file system over SSH. This is something that you can use right now, today, on your Plasma desktop. You just open up Dolphin, the file manager. You click into the little location bar at the top if you have that shown. If not, I think you can go to the Go menu and go. No, you can't. I don't know how to go somewhere when you don't have that enabled. Interesting. I've just had my Dolphin configured in such a way for so long. I think you can probably click into like the breadcrumb trail and it becomes editable or something like that. And if not, then you can go to settings and configure that so that you do see a URI bar, I guess. SSH, no, I think it's fish, actually. /// and then some place that you have access to. Let's do, I guess, since I'm logged in, I'll do, do I have to do bogus@192.168.122.82? Probably. It prompts me for a password, and there's the bogus user account on my virtual server. There's all the files in the home directory. It's that easy. It's just instant satisfaction. It is instant sharing files. It displaces Samba. It displaces NFS, at least for small, you know, very low scale kind of use cases. I'm not saying that it actually negates the need for Samba or NFS. It doesn't. But if you're just a couple of users and you need to you need a quick shared location, and you're all on Linux, then setting up some dummy user on one of the machines or on a server, or you know, however you want to do it, and then just creating an SSH or just using SSH within your file manager to access that shared location. It's that easy. And of course, you can bookmark it in your file manager, so you don't always have to go up there and type in fish. Fish, by the way, is the KIO technology on Plasma desktop using SSHFS in the background. So yeah, SSHFS is fantastic. Can't speak highly enough of it. It's just the best thing in the world. Well, almost the best thing in the world. The actual best thing in the world is, of course, coffee. So let's stop the show, or pause the show. We'll go get coffee. I mean, I'd love to just stop the show and just go get coffee with you, dear listener, but we have work to do. So pause the show, coffee, we'll come back, finish up the show. Okay, I've got my coffee. Hopefully you've got coffee as well, because we're going to talk about S-Tunnel. And S-Tunnel is an SSL, an SSL tunnel between two computers that you can create. It's not super easy to create. It takes a lot of configuration. But then again, on Slackware, you get a pretty good head start. I mean, I think you get the same kind of head start with a lot of distributions, but in a different, you know, in a sort of a different way. But Slackware, you can just kind of see where the head start is. If we go to varlog packages and look at S-Tunnel, the package itself, there are a couple of sample files and a script in etc S-Tunnel. One is called the generate S-Tunnel key. This helps you create the SSL key that you'll need on both, like the key and the certs, that you need on the two systems that you're creating the tunnel between. They both need this PIM file, because without it, they won't be able to do the SSL handshake that would be required for a secure tunnel. So generate -stunnel-key.sh in the /etc/stunnel you run that, and then you've got an S tunnel by PEM. By default, the S tunnel configuration file, which you can see the a starter configuration file in etc S tunnel, stunnel.conf-sample. By default, that assumes your PEM file is in /etc/stunnel, which of course is different than what you might normally expect. You might normally expect your SSL certs to be located in /etc/pki/tls/certs. But for this, just because it is specific to stunnel, it's stored by default in /etc/stunnel. That doesn't mean you can't change the path, but I found it a lot easier to just go with what stunnel wanted me to do. I did one round of adjusting the paths to something that made like sort of broader, more sense to me. And then I kept forgetting, and I would copy something from the configuration file and paste it into my own configuration block and forget that the default of the configuration file was different than my invented path. And so it was just a mess. I would advise against that, especially if it's your first time setting up a tunnel. The way that a tunnel is sort of set up is that it's configured. So if you look in the stunnel.conf-sample file, you can see that there's a bunch of different blocks. Well, there's global options at the top. Those are all the global options. It's pretty clearly labeled in a comment block that it's the global options. They recommend certainly set UID to nobody, set GID to nobody. I mean to no group. I did that. I think honestly, I might have set the. No, I did. I did that. Yeah. Did I? I might have actually set the. Now I have to look. I might have set the group to no body rather than no group. I mean, it doesn't really matter, I guess. Yeah, okay, that's fine. Yeah, no group and no body are both, they both exist. So that's okay. All right, so once you're done with the global settings, and I mean, it's hard to know really what's applicable to you, to your use case. Luckily, there aren't that many to choose from. So the set UID, set GID, set, or not set, the PID file var, which by default it wants to put in the var run stunnel.pid. And I guess I should say, I'm saying by this sample file. There's a disclaimer at the top of this configuration sample that this does not reflect stunnel defaults. It does not represent stunnel.conf defaults. It is just a sample configuration file. Okay, further down around line 50 or so, there is a big comment block that announces service definitions. And these are INI formatted style configuration file. So it's things like, for instance, bracket gmail-pop3 close bracket client equals yes accept 127.0.0.1:110 connect equals pop.gmail.com:995. So that's the key right there. That's the thing to remember. Accept on the client side, the accept line defines where you are going to send a thing. You can almost think of this as a SOCAT, except stunnel. Accept is where you're going to send data. The connect is where the stunnel needs to end up at. Now, once again, whether or not that destination knows what the heck to do with what you've sent through the pipe depends on the destination. In this case, this Gmail example, I'm assuming, I haven't tried it, but pop.gmail.com:995 probably knows what to do with data sent to it, like, you know, authentication data and stuff. So that should work out fine. But what's happening here is that this is basically intercepting stuff that would normally otherwise go out on port 110, and it's making sure that that connects up to port 995, which is going to expect SSL data over on the other side. And that's kind of the key thing to really, really remember. Now, generally, and for some reason, they're not defined here. Oh, that's a, yeah, of course, they're not defined there because the certs would be differently, would be different rather. So if you're doing this with, you know, your own, between your own two servers, then you're going to do things like, I don't know, pop 3s, accept equals 995, connect 110, cert equals etsy slash stunnel slash stunnel dot pim. There's that certification, that cert file, that cert bundle. On the other end, you're kind of doing it the other way around. You're saying, yes, stunnel, I want you to accept from 110 and connect to 995, but you're still using the same cert, so that PEM file needs to be on both of your servers. Both ends of the tunnel need to have access to whatever cert your bundle you're trying to use over like a TLS connection. So there's a bunch of different samples in the file. There's one for like a shell, a remote shell protected with PSK authenticated TLS. There's one for HTTPS. I feel like this is an important tool, but probably a tool that is less and less, I guess, urgent now, because I feel like so many services nowadays are enabling SSL. So I don't know if stunnel is a thing that will be required for much longer. I could be wrong. There could be a glaring gap in the industry that I'm just not aware of, where there's just something that people are using all the time and it's completely not encrypted and blah blah blah. I don't know. But this is, I mean, you could encrypt Telnet, for instance, and then all that Telnet stuff that you want to do, you could be doing with Telnet, unless you were just using OpenSSL, the command, in the first place. But I mean, by OpenSSL's own admission, it's not a very robust way of testing ports and things. So Telnet still has a place, but it is not encrypted. So you could S-tunnel your Telnet traffic, for instance. I mean, you'd have to create a Telnet service block in the configuration file, and figure out what ports you wanted to connect to, and distribute the keys and so, or the PIM files and so on. Next in the list is TCP underscore wrappers, whatever. Yes, wrappers. TCP underscore wrappers. It's in, obviously, var log packages. You can see the list. It's not a very long list of things that get installed. Specifically, there's a header file and a library called libwrap.a or something like that. I think it's libwrap.a. Either way, inetd runs when it receives a request to run something. Instead of running that thing first, it runs TCPD. TCPD logs the request, does a couple of checks about like the location of various files that it expects to exist somewhere for this to have been a valid request, and then assuming everything checks out, TCPD runs the thing that was requested. And the thing could be anything from Telnet to Finger to FTP or RSH or a bunch of other things that you're probably not going to run. So that's TCP wrappers. Apparently, according to the description here, it says nearly all the network daemons on Slackware are wrapped using this library, and most daemons in etsy inetd.conf use TCP underscore wrappers. That's the TCPD wrapper daemon. So most things get processed by this. It allows for better monitoring. It logs things that are happening on your system. Seems like a good idea. Hey, speaking of monitoring, the next one is TCP dump, which, once again, I could probably do an entire episode just on TCP dump and then some. I mean, this is huge. This is the tool that you need to monitor a network, really. I mean, it's not the only tool, but I mean, it's one of those foundational tools. It's huge. It's a big deal. Okay, so I'm gonna log into my virtual machine here, but I'm gonna do it through the GUI because I don't want to clutter up the TCP line with the SSH connection. So I log in, I start a console, and I'm gonna do, I guess to start with, I have to learn how to type on a QWERTY keyboard again. TCP dump. Let's just do dash H. Nope. Where's the H? Here? Yeah. On the H key. Yeah. So dash I. Well, actually, first I need to know what the heck my network card is. So, first things first. I'm going to do IP. Adder. Oh my gosh, I cannot type. Show. And okay, so on this virtual machine, the Ethernet is actually just called ETH0. It's very nice. I love that. TCP dump dash I, ETH0. That's all I'll do initially. And I've got a little bit of activity there. Kind of comes and goes. Not much to look at, but you can see that you know there's signals being sent, broadcasts being sent, to kind of give this computer awareness of where it is on the network and what else is around. Okay, so over in my desktop terminal now, I'm going to just do a straight ping. 192.168.122.82, of course. So we know from previous episodes what kind of signal that sends. It's an ICMP signal. And over here in my virtual machine window, I see a lot more activity now. And they're being labeled ICMP echo reply, ID blah, length 64, length 65, so on. So, well, it should just be 64. These lengths of 35, that's the so the request is 64, the reply is 35. So that's cool. That's neat to see. I'm going to stop the pinging from my desktop. And let me try this, and this won't exactly work, but it's a good segue into what will work. So I'll do SSH. And I have to make up a name here because I don't want to actually connect. I'll do SSH frog at my virtual machine 192.168.122.82. I'm prompted for a password. I'll just put in hello world. That's not a valid password. And like, if I look really hard, I'd probably be able to see that request come through, but it's not like you don't get a big message saying, you know, SSH received, you know, like it's, or maybe you do, but it flies by so quickly that you'll miss it. So that's where just getting a straight dump. I mean, there's nothing wrong with getting a straight TCP dump off of an interface. Like, that definitely works. You can capture that in a file and then analyze that file with some other application later. That's a technique. It's not a bad technique. In fact, that's the most realistic, probably, use case, really. You're not going to be launching TCP normally and just staring at your screen waiting for something interesting to happen and not fly off your screen the moment it does happen. But either way, let's try something a little bit different here. So I'm going to cancel out of that command, and then I'm going to do a TCP dump dash ieth 0 dash lowercase n for no domain name resolution. And then capital X so that we can see the headers, all the header information as kind of a hex dump. If you recall the, what was it called? Hex dump, right? Was that the application? Hex dump dash dash canonical or something like that. Maybe it wasn't that one. But yeah, there are things with hex dumps. You get to see all the bits in sort of in a more or less ASCII representation. can be difficult to read, but you know, in certain protocols, there's a lot to be seen. Whether or not you understand it doesn't really matter. It's just that there's data there. Dash lowercase n capital X and then space port space 22. So we're just going to listen to SSH. Just listening on the SSH port. So we'll do SSH over on my desktop now. SSH fake at 192.168.122.82. I'm saying fake instead of bogus because bogus would just automatically SSH in because I have keys set up. Don't want that. I want to sit here at the password prompt and then I'm going to look back at my virtual machine. And sure enough, I've got a bunch of header packet headers here, including one that kind of identifies what exactly has been going on a little bit. Like here's a libssh.org ecdh sha2. So at least I can see from that a little bit of SSH activity has happened. I mean, you would think so. It's on port 22. But filtering out the, you know, what you're looking for sometimes is kind of useful. So I'm going to go back to my desktop. I'll type in a fake password. Go back to my virtual machine. And again, you see a bunch of data that you're not probably likely to understand. It's a hex dump, and then in the right column, there's the ASCII representation of it. Not very useful because it's all encrypted. Okay, so I'm going to cancel out of that for a moment. I'm going to do telnet on my desktop. Telnet 192.168.122.82. And of course, I'll do this to port 22. Okay, so now I've connected to an SSH prompt, and I'm just going to type in hello space world. And once again, go back to my virtual machine, look around, and really interestingly, in the ASCII column over on the right, you see, if you scroll up a little bit, like I say, this is very, very verbose. So this is not the ideal way of doing a TCP dump. I'll demonstrate the ideal way in a moment. But there's the string, hello world, right there. Like that's what I typed in to telnet. So yes, I received it. And then it even decodes a couple of, a little bit more, like invalid SSH identification string. So we're getting a little bit of information here. Like I say, you can get a lot more information using other applications to parse TCP dump. But one of the ways that that you would start that potentially is by capturing the TCP data stream to a PCAP file is what it's called, and that it's a PCAP packet capture. So you can do like TCP dump, whatever you want. And then dash W for probably write, dash W, my traffic dot PCAP or whatever. It can be any file really, doesn't matter. But you can then open that PCAP file in something like Wireshark and you'll get a lot more information, or at least you'll have a lot of information in a sort of a static setting where you can kind of crawl through it and examine it and kind of explore what was actually happening. This is really important when you're running a server, like to do a TCP dump. Sometimes you'll learn all kinds of information about what's actually happening on your system that you're not necessarily cognizant of on an everyday basis. And it might kind of inspire you to set up some more protections against outside influence. When I was running servers that were actually, you know, like out there in the real world, just looking at TCP dump, I mean, it convinced me to do so many things. Like, I mean, fail to ban certainly, but a lot more like firewall stuff. Just seeing the arbitrary requests, and not just one. I mean, it's hours of arbitrary requests trying to get into your system, because there are scripts out there that people are running that just are, they're just, that's what they do. They just try to get into the system any way possible. And it's sometimes ways that you just don't even think are a thing because you're not thinking about that. You're not thinking about maybe your MySQL port, or you're not thinking about, yeah, your SSH port or something. I don't know. Whatever you're not thinking of, TCP dump may well convince you to start thinking about it. So try it sometime. It's really fascinating. Next up is Telnet. I've talked about Telnet in the past. I've demonstrated how Telnet is arguably not as important as it used to be because there's OpenSSL, which you can use client_S to essentially do the same thing. But Telnet connects to a port. That's what it does. If the port doesn't exist, or it's behind a firewall, so it functionally doesn't exist, then it fails. But if it does exist, it connects to the port. Whether or not it does anything, I mean, you haven't authenticated just because you've connected to a port. As we've done, I think, previously, you can do things like telnet example.com. And no, I need to do example.com/80. There we go. And it's connected to example.com port 80 now. But I mean, that's useless. That it's not like you're like in their web server. You're just at their port 80, and you can issue it commands that possibly the protocol that exists at port 80 would expect, and then maybe you'll get a response that makes sense. But you can also, as I said, just use OpenSSL client_S for that, and it does basically the same thing. Plus, you have the ability to actually, like, you know, test, like, mail servers and things like that. So I don't know. Telnet, I mean, it is still useful. I've used it a couple of times during this episode. So, I mean, I think it's enduring because it is still a tool that is useful. It has useful functionality. It is a very simple syntax. I'm sure there's a lot more you could do with Telnet that I don't even know about. But for that basic kind of like, hey, does this port exist? What's this port doing? What would it respond to? That kind of testing, Telnet is great. It's just important to keep in mind, obviously, that it is also not encrypted. Next up is TFTP. This is a simple terminal command to connect to an FTP server. Again, there aren't that many of them out there. But I've demonstrated how to set one up in a previous episode with Pro FTP. So you could set one up yourself and then connect to it with TFTP. Although, the funny thing is that this the description of TFTP says it provides very little security and you should only use it if it is expressly required. So I guess you wouldn't want to use this. I mean, anyway, I would not use it. I would use NCFTP or LFTP, both of which we've covered as well. I don't know why TFTP is here. Maybe it's got, I don't know, like a weird quirk that other things don't. I mean, I don't think it has any more features than others. Anyway, it's here. So let's really quick try to launch something. So I'm going to just type in TFTP, and I get a prompt, parentheses 2, like T-O, close parentheses. So I'm assuming that it's asking me to go to a server. So I'm going to go to ftp.freebsd.org, because that seems like an easy thing to remember. Now I'm at a prompt, another TFTP prompt. So I guess I should be able to do ls. Nope. dir, no. Okay, question mark? No, I don't believe I've connected. That's weird. What did I do wrong? Okay, maybe I've got the address wrong. Let me look at the FreeBSD. I mean, I don't need to connect to FreeBSD. It's just, I thought that was going to be the easy one. Okay, actually, apparently it's not, no, it is. ftp.freebsd.org is a legacy name. download.freebsd.org is recommended. Okay, so we'll do a connect return and then download.freebsd. No. Okay. How about connect? Maybe I have to put the protocol in, ftp://download.freebsd.org? No, name or service not even understood. Okay, so I don't know. Don't use TFTP, I guess. Nothing against it. I don't know why it's not working, but in CFTP is, I think, I mean, it's a really, really robust application. LFTP, if you need to script it, there's just, yeah, those are two really great options. I don't know what's up with FTP right now. It's clearly not working. Next one up is TIN, T-I-N. This is another Usenet reader, believe it or not. And this one is pretty straightforward in a way. I mean, I found it straightforward. So I still have my environment variable set. I'll do an echo nntp server just to make sure. news.eternal-september.org. Yep, that's there. So I'm gonna type TIN, TIN, and I get an error. It says reading config file, can't open var lib news active. Try TIN-R to read news from over nntp. So I guess TIN by default expects me to have sort of cached news in a spool file, essentially, which I don't, and I wouldn't even know how to set that up myself, nor care to. So I'm going to do TIN space dash R. And again, this is just with that environment variable set. So I'm not passing it any further information. I have no configuration file in place. TIN-R, connecting to news.eternalseptember.org. Message of the day. This is a sample message of the day. That's funny. So that's what that's the news. The MOTD of theirs is still the sample. And then here's that same top level list of news groups. And I can go into, for instance, eternalseptember.test. And it takes a little while to load it. It does load it, and I guess it must have loaded all the headers, which is quite different than SLRN. You'll recall that sort of interrupted the process and said, hey, there's like 14,000 things here. Although to be fair, there's not 14,000 things here. There's 232 top-level messages. Obviously, some of these are going to have threaded replies, so there's probably a lot more than that. But yeah, that seems relatively easy. I'll go into a test message because this is a bunch of tests. This is from Bob V at bananacore.nl.invalid. incredible. And what can I do to get out of this? I can hit Q. Yeah, Q to get back, just like in SLRN. Yeah, seems pretty straightforward, really. I kind of like this. What if I hit P for post? No, that's not the secret code for posting. I don't know how to post, actually. That, I'm not sure. No, W is post, as in probably, like, write. I guess I'll pretend like I'm going to do a test. I don't think that this will work, but I'm going to do test from, what's it, TIN? Yeah. Oh, it reads, it opens up Emacs. That's fancy. I'm going to just put a fake name in here. I'll put test user, test from TIN, summary, just a test from TIN, keywords, test, I don't know. Okay, bad address in from header. Oh yeah, because I didn't, that's fair. That is fair. I didn't put an address. I just put fake user and then nothing. So I'll put none. At none.nl.invalid. I liked that. Test from TIN, test. Okay, there we go. If your article contains quoted text, blah, blah, blah. Yeah, I think P for post. And it claims that I've now posted something. I don't know. I don't see it, but maybe it got posted. I'm not sure. Or maybe... Maybe there's a delay. Maybe I have to reload this. If I quit and then go back into that news group, would it load that then? Yes, it does. Oh my gosh, I did it. I posted to a news group live here on air. So yeah, if you go to eternalseptember.talk, no, sorry, .test, in, oh no, where did it go? Did I put it in talk? Oh dear, I did. Oh man, they're going to be angry. Well, someone, if anyone's on this server, they will be annoyed at this. Darn, I can't believe I did that. Yes. So if you go to eternal-september.org, the news.eternal-september.org, and look in the eternal-september.talk news group on August, I don't know what today is, August 2nd-ish, you'll find, yeah, August 2 at 15:16, you'll see a fake user from none at none.nl.invalid news group Eternal September Talk. Oops. Summary test from 10. Keyword test. That's it. That's my message to the world. How embarrassing that I put it in the wrong place. So hitting Q a lot will quit the application. That was fun. That was really cool. I don't believe I've ever done that before. So that was really cool. And really actually intuitive. Like that's really easy to do. Okay, so let's just do one more just because, like, why not? We're almost through the T section, so it just seems like the right thing to do. And this is traceroute. You know this. This is a classic. If you've ever done any networking on Linux at all, you'll know traceroute. Traceroute literally traces the route from your computer to some other location. So if I do a traceroute to 8.8, so traceroute space 8.8.8.8, that's to the, well, let's find out where that is too. That takes me out of my gateway server, shows me the IP address right there, sends me to a couple of different servers between me and dns.google 8.8.8.8. So there you go. I could also do like a traceroute to example.com, and again, it shows me the way I get to example.com, and it shows me the IP address that I ended up at, 93.184.215.14, and that's it. So yeah, I mean, that's what traceroute does. There's not a whole lot more to it. You can look at the man traceroute, obviously. I mean, I hate saying that because it just sounds like, oh, you should look it up yourself, which is what this show is supposed to be doing. But you know, I mean, there's things like, I don't know, --, don't fragment, use a different gateway, use a different interface, use a different protocol for probing, which is kind of interesting. In fact, in the options for probing, you know, where your signal has gone, there are the default is called by the man page, the traditional ancient method of trace routing used by default. Probe packets are UDP datagrams with so-called unlikely destination ports. The unlikely port of the first probe is 33434. Then for each next probe, it's incremented by one. Because the probes are expected to be unused, the destination host normally returns an ICMP unreached port as a final response. Nobody knows what happens when some application is listening for such a port, though. This method is allowed for unprivileged users, so that's why it's being used by default. To do it differently, like with ICMP instead, or --I for short, then you have to use sudo. So you're doing a sudo traceroute -i, 8.8.8.8 or whatever, example.com, whatever you want to traceroute to. There's TCP as well, so you could do that. It's a well-known modern method intended to bypass firewalls even. So you can try that. You can do like a sudo traceroute -i 8.8.8, and you get a different set of responses from the default. Or you can do a --T for TCP, and you get yet a different set of responses. Actually, I think probably worse for the TCP. I'm on the 17th, 21st. I'm in the 20s of hops, whereas on the ancient traditional method, I only made 9 hops. I don't know. Did the traditional one skip something or something? I don't know. Maybe I needed to set more flags for that one. Who knows? Point is, there are some options that you can try for traceroute, but honestly, I mean, every time I use it, I just use the default because it's usually good enough. It usually at least tells you, like, am I getting out of my gateway server? That's very frequently what I'm checking. And also, what is the destination anyway? Where is this? What is this place? You know, kind of as a quick and dirty host or something, you know, like hostexample.com. I mean, that's pretty quick. I mean, traceroute is actually slower, but I don't know. Sometimes I do that anyway. And you can also trace route over IPv6 by doing the -6 option. So that's trace route over IPv6. That's everything for this episode, I think. Thanks very much for listening. I'll talk to you next time.